Welcome to Brain and Avat. We are delighted to be rejoined by one of our favorite guests, Stephen Kirshner. Stephen only ever talks about the milk toast topics, the most boring, dull things. And today I thought, Steve, can you just do something a bit interesting, please? Can we talk about something that people care about? So we're going to do immigration. Steve, start with a thought experiment.
I'm going to just give a quick background as to where we are in the U.S. In the U.S. right now, we have roughly 50 million immigrants in the country, 15% of the population. These are both record highs from the time the U.S. started taking these sorts of numbers. Depending on the estimates, President Joe Biden has let in somewhere between 6 and 10 million migrants, which I'm going to use the word migrant to mean illegal alien, but it's slightly less hard. So 6 to 10 million migrants and 50 million, 15% of the population. So here are my two thought experiments. Number one, imagine that you have a group of people who formed a partnership and they discover a Pacific island. They gain ownership to it through however you gain ownership in land, right? Whatever you think satisfies justice acquisition. And the partnership then owns the island. The question is, does anyone have a right to immigrate to the island? And I claim the answer is no. If they own it, and if rights consist largely or entirely of property rights, and there are collective property rights, then no one has a right to immigrate to that island. Second case, imagine that the partnership purchases the island. So they gain it through just and transfer. That is, who initially gained the ownership, gained it in a just manner, and then it gets transferred in a just manner to them. Again, it seems that they have a right to exclude someone who wishes to immigrate to the island. Okay, now, how does this relate to the U.S. and to countries in general? Well, I claim the following is true. If there is no right to immigrate and there is no consequentialist overrider, then then people, particularly the owners of the collective property, may exclude would-be immigrants. I think, in fact, there is a right to exclude immigrants, and that there is no consequentialist overrider, and hence the owners of collective property in a nation may exclude potential immigrants. What follows from this is that there is no right to immigrate. In particular, the deontological claim regarding open borders is mistaken.
So who is the collective that owns, for example, the United States? Are you saying that it's the state? Is it the state plus the citizens? Is it just the citizens? Who owns the United States?
Good. I think it's the citizens that own the collective property. So, for example, imagine that a would-be immigrant showed up and walked into Fort Knox, where the U.S. keeps its gold, even aside the fact that this is probably well locked up. And he brings a wheelbarrow and he starts loading in gold bricks. And someone says, hey, what are you doing? He's like, well, who owns it? There's no individual who owns it. Yes, but the collection seems to own it. And if the collection seems to own it, and I think the collection is the citizenry, then they may say, no, you may not take our gold bricks. For the same reason, you may not set up a toll booth on our highways, and you may not, build buildings in the middle of our national parks. What explains this is collective property. And this is true even if you think that libertarianism is correct, even if you think that collective property is wrong, the fact that we're in the world of the second best, that is, there is collective property, entails that there is a right to exclude immigrants. One more thing is, if you thought that immigrants had a right to become citizens of the country, then that is not true. They're in fact joining a partnership, and to join a partnership, you need the valid consent of the partners. So without the valid consent of the partners, they would not have a right to be a citizen. But again, there are two issues. One, do you have a right to immigrate to the country? And two, do you have a right to become a citizen of it?
It's a useful exercise to think about the different ways in which you could be in a country. So let's return back to your thought experiment with the private island owned by three people. And there's someone who's shipwrecked and they're on a little raft and they wash up onto the island and there's nothing else in sight. And you now have a discussion between the three owners of the island about what to do with this person. Let's say all of them say, this guy can't be on the island. We're going to push him back into the sea and he's going to die. Would that be permissible, or would this person have a right to refuge? Maybe he doesn't have a right to be a permanent citizen on the island, Maybe he has a right to remain there for some limited period of time until a boat picks him up. But it seems like he's got some kind of right to life. And if they push him onto the ocean, they're infringing that right. The other one is, let's say that two out of the three say, let's let the guy in. But the third guy says no. Does he get a veto? Because he says, well, I'm an owner of this place and I don't want this filthy refugee sullying my island. So I veto you two guys. In the partnership situation, as you mentioned, you might have to have unanimous consent to decide who becomes a partner. Would that be the same case in the country?
Let's cover the duty to save case. So you have an island and a person, if he doesn't get on the island soon, he's going to drown or he's going to be eaten by the sharks. So does he have a right to immigrate to the island? There, I think the answer is no. Why not? Well, number one, I don't think it's a duty to save. And you can see this in several ways. First, if there were a duty to save, there'd be a correlative right. If I have a right to someone's, if I have a right to someone's property or to their labor, then I have a right to control it. And if I have a right to control it, in some sense, I own it. But I don't own another person's property and I don't own another person's labor. So there is no right to save. And if there's no right to save, there's no correlative duty to save. In addition, usually when people think there's a duty to save, they say something like, well, there's a duty to save when the cost is reasonable. Well, reasonable is not going to be a feature of a right. Rather, that indicates what we have here, something like a consequential consideration, right? Because a sort of cost-benefit analysis that determines what's reasonable is going to be a evidence that we're using a cost-benefit analysis. Third, you can see there's no duty to save because if there was, it would be a disjunctive right. Right. So, for example, there's 10 people drowning and I can only save one of them. Well, which one do I have the duty to save? The answer is, well, one of them, but not anyone in particular. That's really mysterious. I mean, what would ground a disjunctive duty? And then lastly, it's just counterintuitive. Imagine that my family and I want to go on vacation to Scandinavia and it's going to cost, $10,000. But we could spend that money to the Oxfam Relief Agency and maybe save a life or two. Is it wrong to go on the vacation? I think intuitively the answer is no. But if that's true, because distance doesn't matter morally, the same thing should be true if the person needs life-saving help and is close to me. That is, it shouldn't matter whether they're half a world away and it's done via money or 10 feet away and would have to be done through some effort. So I don't think there's a duty to save someone because, I don't think it's a correlative right. So if there is a duty to save someone, it's going to have to be a consequential overrider. But I don't think that's true. I mean, it's okay to go to Europe, even if it means you're giving less money to the Oxfam Relief Agency. Now, it's probably virtuous to save someone. It probably indicates that you're a kind person, but that's different from saying you have a duty to save it. Regarding the procedure, it's a fascinating issue as to what do you do with collective property when there's no decision procedure that's been decided. So imagine that you have a partnership and you haven't bothered to specify what's the decision procedure by which you decide what should happen to the property. And here what you have is a vague right. And I'm not sure what to say about a vague right. I suspect what we want to say is there's just no answer to this and that the parties are going to have to decide by whatever procedure, how to set the decision procedure. Of course, that's just going to push, it's going to beg the question, because they have to decide, well, what's the decision procedure by which to decide the decision procedure. But the fact that you can have vague rights and perhaps no way out of them with regard to vague collective rights doesn't mean that if the three people decide the person may not come to the island, the person may not come onto their island. And by analogy, if the person needs a kidney of one of the three to survive, not coming to the island, but needs a kidney, I think the answer is no. No one has a duty to provide the drowning man or the man in the ocean with one of their kidneys. Well, what's the difference? It's just the cost per individual. And why should the cost per individual tell us whether or not there is a right present? So, no, I mean, they're permitted not to save them, but it would certainly be supererogatory and virtuous to do so. Notice that most immigration cases have no relation to this, right? With the exception of refugee cases, most immigrants are not immigrating in order to stay alive, right? I mean, well over, over 90%, for example, of asylum claims are rejected. So it's just not true. So even if there were a duty to save based right to immigrate, and I claim there is not, This would be inapplicable to the vast amounts of people immigrating all over the world, and particularly to the U.S.
Let's think about what it would mean for the citizenry of a country to give valid consent for a particular person to pass through the border. That just seems totally bizarre to me. So, like, what would it mean for the collective of the United States to decide on whether Mark is allowed to immigrate there, for example? Would they need to look on a case-by-case basis, the collective citizenry? Like, would you need to, like, hive mind them and find, would you need to do a poll for every person who's going to pass over the border? And if not, are there going to be due representatives? Is it the state that decides? But you said the state doesn't own the country. The citizenry owns the country. And it seems like the people could disagree with what the state decides. Is it a majority? Do we say, well, you know, we can predict what the citizenry as a whole would decide? Are there sort of thresholds? Like, once you go past a certain percentage, whether that be at the 50% mark, is it 70%? Is it barring a good reason not to let Mark in that the citizenry would in principle consent? I just find that really weird. And I find it weird in small groups even. So, like, let's say you've got the partners of the island. When you've got two, it's pretty clear, right? They both say yes or they both say no. When you've got 10 and let's say six say yes and four say no, does that mean that the partners have decided yes? In the absence of rules that the partners have agreed to about what constitutes collective consent. And as you make that group bigger, it just gets very strange to me. And to me, if that's so vague and so unspecified, surely this is just a bad account of who owns a country.
First of all, the U.S. should jump at taking Mark. I mean, it would be lucky. There should be real competition as to who should allow Mark to immigrate there. But second, what do you do with a vague right? With a vague right that does not have a decision procedure? There are two things you might say. You might say, one, the right exists, but it's vague. Or you might think that there's no such right, that a right that does not have kind of a remedy or a way in which it can be operated doesn't exist at all. So let's take each of those. Imagine that you have a vague right. I mean, you might think this is fairly common, right? I mean, what do you do when you have marital property and the husband and wife disagree as to whether the husband's drunken brother gets to come onto the property? I mean, what's the answer, right? Who has the right to decide? Do they have to unanimously, or can either one okay it? Same thing if you have a partnership. Imagine if people form a law partnership, but they don't have a decision procedure with regard to hiring, right? What is the rule with regard to hiring, right? You might think, well, because they jointly own it, they can decide what is the decision procedure for cases like this. But of course, you need a decision procedure to adopt the decision procedure. So perhaps there's no right at all, in which case, because I claim that deontological ethics consists of and only of rights, we're going to have to go straight consequentialist. But if you think there is, there can be rights that are vague with regard to decision procedure, then I guess so long as you're within one of those decision procedures. Still, we have unanimous or near unanimous disapproval. This is probably within the counts of vague rights. So imagine that you have a Westchester County Country Club and you have 200 members, it's enormously expensive, costs $250,000 to join, plus $25,000 a year fee. And you have a bunch of migrants who want to show up and they want to live in the country club. They want to start using the tennis courts and the pool and borrowing the people's clothes. And everyone in the country says, absolutely not. There, even if you have a vague decision procedure, it still seems that violates it. So, I guess if you think that a vague right is no right at all, and there is no right, in which case we have to go to straight consequentialist analysis. I also think, by the way, that on consequentialist analysis, there's good reasons to stop a good deal of immigration, so that even if we go consequentialist, this is going to stop most of the immigration as well. But, I mean, that's going to be a separate issue and require a separate analysis.
So here's one reason to think that the people don't collectively own America. So if I own something, I have certain rights that I can have over that item. So if I own a car, I can decide to set it alight, because it's my car. I can destroy it. I can sell it to my cousin. Now, what does it mean to say, as an American citizen, I own part of America? it doesn't seem like I could transfer any of those rights to someone else. I can't exchange my citizenship with someone else and say, hey, look, I don't want to be here anymore, Mr. Man from France, you can take it. You know, I can't do that, right? I can't transact. Doesn't seem like it's a company where we've got shares. You know, if you're a partner in a firm, you can, you know, get rid of it. If I'm a part owner in a piece of property, you might think that I could do things to that property to destroy it as well. And if I say, well, I own the chairs in the house and my wife owns the house, well, they're my chairs, I can destroy them. But if I, as a citizen of America, start taking a pickaxe to a road, you know, the state's going to get very upset with me and say, you have no ownership rights over this road. So that makes me think that it's not a property right. So the second thing you point out is this idea of it being a private members club. So there you're saying, well, okay, none of us own the country club. We're all members of the club. And maybe we're also custodians of the club. So we have an obligation to protect it for its current members and for future members. And you might think that that's what the state's doing with regards to unowned land. So it says, well, these forests and these roads and all these things, we're the custodian of it for all the other members of the club, all the other citizens. And we take, you know, some of their money and we invest it back into it and we look after it. And we can have decision procedures about who gets to become a member. And that procedure could be there are no new members. We will accept no new applications at all. So you can imagine, you know, there's sufficient consensus to say no new members. And that's why you can stop all immigration. But I wonder if it's fair to compare private members clubs to states.
Let me separate out the two issues. One, why I think they could be collective property. Well, if you leaving aside the issue of decision procedure, if you think that there are things that are collectively owned, examples would include roads, airports, the Golden Fort Knox, national parks. And let me say a little bit about national parks federally owned land. Out west, I think it's like a third of the land or so. So we're talking a lot of land. That I do think can be destroyed. It can be sold. It can be transferred to another country. I mean, imagine the U.S., the debt now is $34 trillion. And after a while, the U.S. just can't pay it. And it says, look, we want to sell some of the national parks to wealthier countries. It's a little hard to see why it can't do it. I mean, the citizens collectively own this property. Now, if this were not the case, notice it'd be very mysterious, right? Who would own Fort Knox? So imagine some migrant wants to show up and just start taking some of Fort Knox. And you think, well, you may not take the gold out of Fort Knox. You go, well, why not? I mean, who does own it? The government is not a person, right? So the government can't stand in a moral relation to another, to the migrant. Well, who else could? So I think that one, there is collective property. And if there is collective property, then you have the rights that accompany property ownership, including the full-blooded property rights to destroy things, to sell them, to rent them, and so on. In terms of the country club, I would think in slightly different terms. I mean, there we have collective ownership as well, but you might think citizenship is something that, you know, you think in terms of a partnership or a country club. So not everyone who emigrates to a country becomes a citizen, but you might think the citizens are in some sense the owners of the collective property. And in any case, they are the principal for which the government is the agent. And if that's the case, then something very important applies to it, right? They own the government, they own the collective property, and as a result, they have say over what happens to it. So again, there can be issues of the decision procedure. Do we do individual judgments? Do we do, you know, policy? Do we have, judges make the decision, or, you know, just some administrator, some bureaucrat? But I think these are just decisional elements. Now, note, some of the open border proponents suggest that we allow a lot of people to immigrate to the country, but not to become citizens. And you have to wonder, leaving aside the issue of rights, is this the sort of country that someone wants to live in? So you think of like the UAE, where only 10% of the residents are citizens, or Qatar, where 12% of the residents are citizens. And you have to ask yourself, is that the country you want to live in? I suspect the answer to that is no, but that's what happens if you have kind of open borders, but really limited citizenship. So if you say, well, anyone can come in and use the country club, but the owners remain, you know, the 200 original members, then you're going to end up with something like that.
So the utilitarian view on this, your position is that the utilitarian should also say that immigration should not be permissible to everyone. You're giving cases where widespread immigration has had negative consequences, but one might also look at a different quadrant of consequences, which is cases where banning immigration or firming up borders has also had negative consequences. So a lot of people cite Brexit as one of these examples. So they say that the lack of trade, easy trade with countries and the free movement of people between EU states has made life quite difficult for a lot of people and has harmed the economy in the UK. So the problem I have with the utilitarian case is that you actually need to present evidence in all four quadrants. So you need cases where closing borders has harmed, closing borders has helped, opening borders has helped, opening borders has harmed. How do we assess that evidence? So how do we put together those four quadrants of consequences and then make a final decision on the utilitarian position?
Let me just point out that so one of the things you're getting at, which is a superb point, is that on some estimates, because of the comparative advantage and the fact we're shifting people to where they're much more productive and much more efficient, you know, there are trillions of dollars of additional wealth generated. And that if you don't allow open borders, you're leaving trillion-dollar bills on the sidewalk. And that it's very hard to get enough bad things to override trillion-dollar bills on the sidewalk. Okay, I do not think these arguments succeed. So let me give you the main reason objective, then two others. Number one, this is to make a mistake of not realizing that consequentialism is best understood in totalist terms. The fact of the matter is when you have poverty, particularly grinding poverty, you have a lot more, you have a lot more reproduction, right? You have an exploding population. And in fact, most poor people, people in extremely poor economies are still happy. They're not as happy as people in the advantaged economies, but they're still quite happy. I mean, at least reasonably happy. So when you reduce the population by a lot, by sort of blocking poverty, the fact of the matter is you have a lower total amount of well-being, or total utility. And that's true even if you deserve it adjusted, as a side note. Second, I'll give you another analogy. One of the things which reduces reproduction rate quite a bit is education for women, right? So if you wanted to max utility, one of the things you might do is significantly reduce the education of women. Again, why? Because you get greater reproduction. And if you get greater reproduction, you get more people. And if you get more people, you get more utils. Leave aside issues of animals and sort of people might be harmed by more people. The fact of the matter is, it's not clear that when you generate more wealth, you actually make the world a better place rather than making a worse place. Now, some people will say, well, all right, you know, Kirshner, that's a neat little trick with your totalism. But I'm an averagist. I want to maximize average utility rather than total utility. Okay. Now, this averageism is just is not a plausible theory. Let's just go over the objections. Number one, we often think things like, you know, pleasure is intrinsically good. But if you're an averageist, this is just not true, right? The simple truth is not true. Rather, what you have to do is say, well, pleasure averaged over a number of individuals is intrinsically good. I find this to be to get away from the strong intuition. Number two, you have a problem of mere addition. In our personal lives, we don't think we should average happiness per year, right? If I can live 50 ecstatic years, and you say, well, I can live 25 years that are quite happy but not ecstatic, right? You see this in the work of Parfit, for example. Sure, I'd want those 25 good years, but if you're not an averageist about years in an individual's life, why wouldn't you be an averageist about a population? Third, if averageism is true, then it would seem that the optimal world is just to have one super happy individual or one super happy individual for one maximally great moment. Well, that's implausible. And then fourth, you have issues of Egyptology, right? If we're deciding whether to reproduce and, well, you know, is your child going to make the world a better or worse place? Another powerful point. You have to decide how happy the ancient Egyptians were. But it's just not true that whether or not your child makes the child or the world better or worse depends on how happy the ancient Egyptians are. So assuming you're a totalist, it's likely the case that open borders will reduce overall well-being, or at least we can't be confident that they'll increase it. Second, there's a serious concern about killing a golden goose. If you think that Western economies produce the wealth that they do because they have a large amount of economic and political liberty, and a lot of the newcomers will seriously reduce that amount of economic and political liberty, then there's a reasonable concern that you're not going to get these economic gains, right? And you see this, among others, in the work of Rishi Joshi. And then third, you just have issue of preferences. Preferences count too, even if they don't have, even if we can't directly translate them to dollar value, and I think we can, right? If you think of Japan, right? Japan probably does not want, 100 million of a very different culture moving in. They like the Japanese culture. They like their fellow Japanese people. And if you frustrate their preference, even if there's no financial value we can attach to it, that counts as a negative as well. When they add these three things up as compared to the advantage, comparative advantage of economic gains, it's at the very least not clear which way the balance goes. And I strongly suspect that the negatives outweigh the positives. And just a quick illustration of this, so it's not so abstract. Ireland has roughly 5 million people. They have a per capita income of around $103,000 per person per year. Pakistan and Nigeria. Nigeria has, I think, 213 million people. Pakistan has, I think, 230 million people. So imagine that, so together we're talking about 240 million. So imagine that 20 million from these two countries want to come to Ireland. And look, among other things, you might think, and of course, they're going to change the norms, right? They have different norms than the Irish people have. They have a different culture. Well, one, those preferences should matter. Two, it's not clear that the economic powerhouse that is Ireland will continue if you make it, 5 times larger and, introduce different amounts of political and economic liberty. And then again, there's the consideration that, when you reduce poverty, are you actually making the world a better place? Or when you give women education, are you actually making the world a better place? And it's unclear in totalism that the answer to that is yes. And we should be totalists if we're going to be strict consequentialists.
So what about an argument from national self-interest for having a particular view on migration? So let's say you're in a Western country where you've got a dwindling population. Like most places in the West, you have lower than replacement birth rates. So over time, what's going to happen is that you'll have severe depopulation in Europe and in North America and Australia and in Japan as well. And so there is a national interest in saying we need to import some people so that they're productive and they can look after our elderly and things like that. And maybe you want to have some criteria in place for who you import. So, for example, some of the wealthiest people in America are Nigerians. So it's not that Nigerians are particularly wealthy. It's that a creme de la creme of Nigerians came over. And that might be one of the things that you find with immigration generally, is that the hardest working, those that are willing to take risks, those that have some money are the kind that are likely to arrive on your shores. If you're Australia, you have a points-based system. So you want people to have certain scarce skills, certain amounts of money, to be of a certain age, and you give preference on that basis. So the Australians don't take that many people into their country, but those they take, tend to be high achievers. And that seems like it's in Australia's national self-interest. Australia also has quite a strong view to stop boats from arriving on their shores. So they put out boat patrols that if people arrive, on their shores, they steer them off to another place called Nauru. And they say, if you need a place of safety, well, you can be in Nauru. You don't have a right to Australia, but maybe you have a right to, not be persecuted where you come from, and we'll look after you on Nauru, but you're not coming to Australia. And they've done a deal with the Nauruvians. So it seems like there's an argument for partial migration. Let's say versus the country that says no one gets to be here besides us. It seems like you miss out on a whole range of opportunities that, diversity of different ideas of, the scarce skills that you might be missing, your dwindling population. It could be national suicide to say, no one else gets to be here.
Two things to say here. One is if we are using a rights-based analysis, notice that even if it's prudentially wise to let in meritorious immigrants, that doesn't mean that you have a duty to do so, right? So imagine I have, extra rooms in my house and someone says, look, the rent's really high around here. And someone said, look, if you let in a few renters, your income is going to increase quite a bit for a small level of annoyance, and your renters, because they'll get discounted rent, their lives will increase quite a bit. That may well be true. From it does not follow that I have a duty to rent to them or that they have a right to rent from me. So second, you could see people saying cost, right? I mean, I like not having renters in my house. And you can imagine that the Japanese say, look, I like the Japanese culture. I do not, or the Irish say, I like the Irish culture. I see no reason to swamp my country with people who have different values and different cultural norms. But your point is, okay, maybe that's true. So the people don't have a right to emigrate to immigrate into your country. But, you know, among these high merit, right, the people who are extremely well-educated or are very high IQ or bring a lot of wealth, it's in a country's advantage to bring them in. Okay, a couple of things to say here. Number one, I think that's true. Number two, that has very little relation to what's going on in the U.S., for example, although it might be true in other countries, right? In the U.S., the vast majority of people who are let in are not let in based on merit. In fact, if you look at sort of almost any dimension, at least with certain groups, people coming from, for example, from Mexico and Central America, it's just not true that they have these sort of meritorious features, right? So roughly 2/3 of our immigrants come from those countries, and about 50% of those groups did not finish high school, and another 25% only have a high school degree, right? So they have a lower level of education than the average American, right? Which is one of the reasons that immigrants in general, and particularly immigrant households that are not headed by American citizens, even more so have a quite higher welfare usage compared to the average American. In addition, they also have while immigrants in general do not have this, it is true for certain groups that they have higher out-of-wedlock birth rates. So you have greater welfare usage, you have a much lower educational accomplishment, you have a higher level of out-of-wedlock birth rate. Again, this is for certain groups, not for every group, not for immigrants as a whole. And then there's a very controversial area that I think is relevant, and I'll mention it, but generally people don't want to talk about it because it's impolite. And that is, if you think there are different IQ scores between these different groups, and that IQ scores are stable and a fairly strong predictor of a whole bunch of things like educational success, divorce rate, out-of-wedlock birth rate, criminality, so on and so forth, you might think, look, they're strong predictors. But if you're saying, you know, is it good for your country to let in, you know, Japanese neurosurgeons or, Danish physicists or other individuals or Nigerian chemists, the answer is probably yes. I mean, that is probably in your nation's interest, so long as it's not it's a group which is not small enough to sort of swamp other things you care about. But if you were to think that the elites cannot be trusted to use meritorious admissions, then you might think, look, we're probably better off with a moratorium or some limited tight restriction, because we simply can't trust the people running many countries to have, you know, control of a flexible immigration system. So the short answer is yes. Do I think it's in a country's interest to let in highly meritorious immigrants? The answer to that is yes. Do I think you can trust governments, particularly in the U.S., to implement anything like this? I think the answer is no. And if the answer is no, then you might think the cost of a large immigration system is higher than the cost of a much lower immigration system, and perhaps one that has a flat-out moratorium.
Here's an argument for why the analogy between the partnership owning the island and the citizenry of the United States owning the United States, why that analogy breaks down. So suppose that there's some rules set up by the partnership who owns the island. And those rules stipulate that if one of the members does certain things, they can be kicked off the island. They can be removed as a partner. It seems like that is a coherent scenario. It seems like that's a plausible scenario. But now imagine the same in the case of a country. Are there a set of rules by which the citizenry can kick out another citizen? They can say, sorry, you're no longer American. That seems more difficult. In other words, maybe there are some such scenarios. Maybe like if you defect to another country, then sure. But it seems like the rules under which someone could be kicked out of the partnership of the island are much, much, they're much more inclusive than the situations in which you might be removed as a citizen of a country. But so in other words, it seems like you don't have a right to de-citizen someone, but you do have a right to de-partner them as a co-owner of in a collective of a property. So it seems like there's an important disanalogy.
Yeah, I guess I don't think it's a disanalogy. I think the analogy holds up. So imagine you have a partnership and a group of partners have got together and they have an iron lung that each member uses. And that if you don't get access to the iron lung, that you die. And one partner keeps on battering the other partners and committing sexual assault. And they say, look, here's a decision procedure. If you commit, you know, repeated violent attacks on the other member of the partnership, you're out of the partnership. And the person says, well, look, if you kick me out of the partnership, I'll die. It's a little hard to see what the objection is. And it's a particularly bizarre view, right? That bizarre is too strong, but it's an odd view that it's okay to lock someone in a cage for decades on end. It's okay to execute someone, but it's not okay to kick them out of your country. I mean, it's unclear why that would be an impermissible punishment if the other things are not.
Okay, so what you're biting the bullet on, I thought you'd go the other way, to be honest, Stephen, but you're biting the bullet on saying it's fine to strip someone of their citizenship.
If someone says, look, partnerships may not kick out of partners, you know, particularly when the people have agreed to this rule set and it allows them to kick someone out. I don't see why. I mean, with law firms, if someone is really behaving poorly, there's going to be some decision procedure whereby you can remove one of the partners. And I think it's an odd view to say, well, in the U.S., it's okay to lock someone in a cage for 30 years. It's okay to execute them. And it's okay to draft them into a combat situation, in which they'll actually, you know, the chance of dying is excellent. But somehow those three are okay, but it's not okay to say that you've been excluded from the nation. I mean, what would distinguish the first three from the last one?
So let's switch the discussion then from a rights-based discussion to a utility-based discussion or a consequentialist discussion. It seems like a lot of your arguments rest on this idea that letting immigrants in, at least the consequentialist discussion, a lot of your arguments rest on the idea that letting all these immigrants in will have net negative utility. Bad things will happen. We'll be swamped by people with a lower income. They'll have higher welfare usage, loss of culture, etc. It certainly seems the case that there'll be subgroups within your country which we'd be better off kicking out. Right? Not just for like individual harms, but like whole groups. You could just say, well, this group of people, if you categorize them according to a certain categorization, whether it be ethnicity, it might be age, right? So let's say all old people, right? It seems like if you were to kick out all old people above a certain age, that would have net positive utility because the country wouldn't have to take care of them. So you wouldn't be losing utility points in hospitals. But that seems abhorrent, right? It seems seems abhorrent to ship everyone above a certain age to Nauru, for example. But on your view, there doesn't seem to be, at least not on the deontological discussion, but on the consequentialist discussion, it doesn't seem like there's a reason why you shouldn't kick all people above a certain age out of the country and still not let certain people into the country which might have a higher utility value collectively than old people.
Good. So two consequentialists getting into this sort of discussion. So one concern here is that my main argument against sort of open borders on consequentialist grounds is the reduced reproduction, right? That you're sort of not expanding poverty, you're not blocking women's education in a way which is going to increase reproduction. And of course, we should be totalists. But I mean, what you're bringing out is that consequentialist has a really counterintuitive implications, right? If you think the consequential tells you that you have a strong duty to go around damaging contraception and perhaps even committing rape with regard to fertile women because the overall well-being number is going to increase quite a bit, you might think, well, that's a truly monstrous theory. Well, that is consequentialism, right? So if you think these things are wrong, then you're not a consequentialist. So my guess is just as an empirical matter, kicking out old people and kicking out unproductive people will not maximize utility just because it will so horrify and damage them and their friends that everyone will be worse off. Not everyone, but I mean, on the whole will be worse off. But the fact of the matter is, if it were to do so, then that's what consequentialism requires of us. I mean, consequentialism might require that if you only had two children, you have a strong duty to have another eight. Again, why? Because it's going to increase, you know, aggregate well-being quite a bit. So for the same reason, you might have a duty to execute the depressed, right? If they're dragging down the total and average, then that, of course, is what consequentialism requires. So if consequentialism can require that you damage contraception, perhaps so that you have another eight children if you've only had two, that you execute the depressed, you might think that, okay, once you have these sort of extreme results, what's the objection to the further thing that you should kick out, the sick or the unproductive? But again, I just claim empirically that it just doesn't seem to be true. I mean, imagine we live in a society that sort of kicks out the disabled or the elderly or people who are sort of unproductive because they have mental illnesses. I mean, first of all, we love people like that. I mean, all of us have people in our family or spouses or things like that that suffer from these things. It'd be a horrible thing. And second, those people would suffer enormously. So I claim just as a contingent empirical matter, this would not maximize the good. But, if it were to do so, consequentialism is stuck with what it's stuck with. And so while I think as a contingent empirical matter, it's false, if it were to be true, that's what consequentialism is committed to.
So I want to return a bit to the earlier case I gave with the guy on the lifeboat. And the way you addressed it was to say, this guy doesn't have a right to be on the island, and the owners of the island can say, we're not letting you ashore. Now, I wonder if it makes a difference if the person is on the boat seeking refuge or if they're on the island. And it's not a matter of failing to save, but a matter of actively killing. And that's analogous, of course, to people, let's say, who illicitly gain access to a country while fleeing genuine persecution. So we're just in the refugee case, not, as you say, the ordinary immigrant. You can imagine, for example, someone fleeing from the civil war in Syria, and they arrive in another country, and they get there illegally. They didn't have a right to be there, but they're now there. And if you push them back home, they're going to die with some certainty. The other cases are, let's say you have that person being pregnant, and they then give birth on the soil of the new country. So you might say the new being that's born is totally innocent. They did nothing, to violate anyone else's rights. They didn't intend to be born in America. Can they be sent back home with the mother? Or do the Americans now owe that child an obligation? Seems kind of arbitrary where the person was born. And so it also seems a little bit arbitrary on what basis you confer citizenship. It doesn't seem like you have to have a rule that says being born in the country makes you a citizen. You could have a different rule. Being born here and schooled here makes you a citizen, or you become a citizen at a certain age, or, if enough of us decide you're a citizen because you pass the citizenship test to become a citizen. There's different ways in which you could crunch it. So I wonder what you think you can do to the newly born kid whose mother's fleeing the Syrian civil war.
Right. So let's take the lifeboat case first. So the question is, what must you do to the person who shows up on the boat? Does it matter if the person's on the boat or on the island? And I think that in general, first of all, it seems to me that you're allowed to turn away the person on the lifeboat in the same way that if you go to vacation in Europe and it costs $10,000 and you could save two lives if you donated that money to the Oxfam Relief, you're free to do that. Similarly, you're free not to allow someone not to go on the island. And some people say, well, one's a reasonable burden and one is not. But again, I doubt that rights are keyed into like reasonable burdens. It's hard to see what would justify a right and allow for that sort of burden. But what about eviction? Is eviction a killing or a letting die? So I think that's what you're bringing up. And there I'm a little bit unclear. I tend to think that an eviction is a letting die rather than a killing. I mean, again, imagine that you're having a party and a bunch of people in the party, and one person is completely misbehaving, right? I mean, he's grabbing the other party guests. He's breaking furniture. He's, just destroying things, saying incredibly hateful and offensive things. And you say, look, we're going to kick you out of the party. And he goes, yeah, but if you kick me out of the party, this gang that have run afoul is going to kill me. And you say, well, I'm sorry, you can't stay in the party. And the question is kicking him out of the party counting as a killing or a letting die? Intuitively, to me, especially if you just say, look, you have to leave, but you don't put your hands on them, it looks to me like a letting die. because you're not killing them, the gang's killing them. And by now, if you say, look, we're not going to let you on the island, you know, we're not going to take our barrier down. So, you know, you'll just, your boat will just keep banging into the barrier. It seems to me that you've let the person die rather than killing them. And I guess I just think by analogy, you're not putting your hands on the person's body or his stuff. So I guess it really depends on how you see eviction. Now you said, look, the citizen rule here is arbitrary. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there's different ways to set up a law partnership. You could say, you have to be the very top of your class and every partner has to vote for you. Or you have to say, look, you have to have a plurality of votes to join the law partnership. One says, look, there's all sorts of ways you can join a law partnership. I'm not sure why a citizen partnership should have been different. I mean, there might be difference in terms of consequences and difference in terms of what will maximize the good, but that's separate from saying that there's a certain arbitrariness to the conditions to join a partnership. Now, what about the newly born individual? Now, there's kind of a legal issue here as to what to do with birthright citizenship. Does the Constitution really require birthright citizenship? And it's very controversial from both sides. It's a very, very controversial issue. I tend to think the answer to that is no, but it depends on the interpretation of the particular constitutional clause regarding citizenship, and also, how you think the interpretation should occur through, originalisms, moral reasoning, and these sorts of issues. But I tend to think, look, if you say someone who is newly born that, let's say the woman's committing violence, she's committing fraud, and you say, well, that's it. I mean, you have to leave, and you can either leave your baby behind from orphanage, or you can take your baby with you, but you may not stay. I mean, it's not clear to me that's any different from the person that you're making leave the party. When someone is behaving atrociously at the party, and you say, that's it, out. If that counts as a permissible letting die, it's a little hard to see why kicking out someone who is misbehaving in a similar way is any different. Now, imagine someone's not misbehaving, but they were never invited to the party, right? So some stranger shows up at your party and, he's hanging out with everyone else. He's eating all your food, drinking your alcohol. And you're like, hey, I don't mind you, consuming a lot, but I do mind the fact that you weren't invited. Get out. And he says, well, if you kick me out, this gang that I've run afoul is going to kill me. And you might think, well, maybe I'm allowed to do that, maybe not. But in any case, kicking you out of the party and evicting you is a letting die. It's not a killing. And so the issue is, would the letting die be okay in this case? I'm tempted to say yes. But the issue is, when is letting die okay with regard to someone who's violated your immigration laws by illegally coming to your country, or sort of misbehaving once they're there? For example, they're beating people up and stealing and so on and so forth.
I'm curious whether these arguments go through for other countries. So in other words, in other countries, it may be the case that open borders would result in net positive utility, even if they were swamped. So maybe if Nigeria opened its borders, for example, you'd have a whole lot of Irish coming coming in. And so it would help the overall utility. So do the scope of these arguments only apply to countries that are better off on average than other countries?
So I think you make an excellent point. Now, my arguments here are generalized. With regard to the consequentialist argument, I guess it depends on whether or not they end up encouraging, sort of grinding poverty and decrease women's education, things like that, that slow down reproduction. So you could imagine a case, for example, where the Japanese are not reproducing at a replacement rate. And so you have an equal number of other people show up who are reproducing at a fast rate. And so you're getting much more individuals, even though the Japanese people are less happy. I mean, it could well be that the overall gain in consequences vastly outweighs the losses. So it's going to be country specific. And it's going to not only be country specific, but the more general effects on things like reproduction. So there's no way to escape the kind of contingent factors. And it might well be that you are going to some of these poor countries, again, if you were looking at average well-being, which I don't think you should, but if that's what you're looking at, it might increase quite a bit. I mean, if you you have a number of people with high capital, right? Either they bring a lot of money, a lot of education, or high IQ, and they're really going to make the people wealthier, they're going to improve the political and economic liberty, and they're going to reproduce at a fast clip, yeah, I mean, they might well increase the average level of well-being. And insofar as you're concerned with average levels of well-being, then that would improve the people in that country's position. We have to be a little bit careful about averages and the totalism as opposed to person affecting morality, right? You might think there are two different issues. That is, are you going to make the people who are already there, their lives better? That's one issue, or we can focus on whether or not you're going to make the total or average higher. And of course, the two need not align, right? I mean, you could have a person affecting morality that is distinct from the total and average. I think the person affecting morality is particularly implausible, but someone might think that's what we should focus on, right? Are we going to make the existing individuals currently in that country better or worse off with immigration? As a theory of consequentialism, I don't think it's a good one. As a theory of obligations, I think it is a good one, right? I mean, if the government is your agent, you're the principal, the government is your agent, well, yeah, the government should focus on making your lives go, your its principals' lives go better. So, but I'm guessing that Jason, that you're not terribly sympathetic to personal affecting morality. Is that fair?
Yeah, so I think you should care about the total utility in that society or within those borders. So in other words, if Nigeria were to open its borders, I take it that if others immigrated there, they might be better off as a whole if you were to sum everyone's utility and you didn't weight the previous residents as more important. I think overall you would have high utility, and so Nigeria is morally obligated to open its borders.
Right. Right. So then that's going to depend on whether or not we're increasing or decreasing the total amount. What happens if we import these very meritorious immigrants and they make the lives and the average income of Nigerians so much better that they begin reproducing at the level of the Japanese? That is, they have below replacement reproduction rate.
The empirical question is, will total utility go up or down? There are long-termist versus medium-termist considerations. So are we looking over the medium term, the short term, the long term? That's also potentially an objection to your view that you shouldn't open borders in the US because, maybe in the short term you have these problems, but maybe in the long term, for example, if America were to reproduce it at under replacement rate without open borders and then you open borders, in 10 generations' time, you actually have a much better scenario because you've got actual existing humans within those borders, whereas you wouldn't have had nearly as many without opening your borders, then there's a long-termist consideration for why you should open those borders. So we have to somehow specify a line and say, well, you know, what morality demands is looking this far in advance, this far ahead. And it's very hard to do
so that. I think you're absolutely right. What matters are the consequences, all consequences, no matter how far ahead. But we have to be modest about our ability to predict things 75 years from now, right? I mean, if you're doing a study like the National Academy of Sciences and you're saying, well, look, 75 years from now, you know, each type of immigrant, no matter what the person's level of merit, will have a positive effect. You're like, how can you accurately predict 75 years from now? I mean, in the U.S., the predictions with regard to the financial state, both the costs and the the revenue of Social Security and Medicare were wildly off. I mean, we're wildly off on all sorts of things, right? I mean, a lot of us certainly did not see the computer generation coming, let alone what the AI generation does. So I think you're absolutely right. I just don't think we can accurately predict, 500 years from now or even 75 years from now.
Sure, but then you can't use that argument for the Japanese who come into Nigeria. You can't have your cake in the one scenario, but not in the other scenario. You've got to eat it in both or in neither. So it's like, if you're going to consider long-term calculations in Nigeria, then you've got to do so in America. And if you don't in the one case, then you shouldn't in the other.
Sure. If making consequential conclusions requires having knowledge of the long-term effects, and we can't have knowledge of long-term effects, and we can't have knowledge of the consequentialist balance, and hence we can't tell us what is or is not a consequentialist duty. I mean, there is one nonetheless, but we don't know what it is.
Right. So now I really like that discussion, right? So the one way you could go on that, which seems to be the way you've gone, which is, well, if we're just not sure either way, well, then no one has a right to enter. I think maybe if you're not sure either way, you should assume that everyone has a right to enter. So in other words, you know, why I think it goes, if you're not sure, surely you should increase liberty, not decrease it.
I'm guessing if you're, I mean, I have exactly the same preference you do, that when in doubt, put the thumb on the scale of liberty. But I also think that if we're going to be totalists, we should put the thumb on the scale on the side of greater numbers of individuals. And so the real concern would be, what do we know about greater reproduction? And greater reproduction is not going to come about, at least we're looking at correlation, and I assume that's evidence, some evidence, I'm not convincing evidence, of causation, that it's not going to happen if we have like $1 trillion bills on the sidewalk. So I think you're right in terms of my preferences, and I think you're right in terms of rights, that when in doubt, we should favor liberty. I'm just not sure that that's a great consequentialist principle.
So it seems strange to me to think that you could hive off your consequentialist calculations by state, so that you could say morality requires America to do X. It seems like utilitarians are supposed to care about total utility everywhere and all places at all times. So there's this strong egalitarian impulse in it, and therefore a cosmopolitan impulse in it. And so that means when we're deciding what would maximize the good, you've got to take everyone's interest into account. And so it seems like Steve cares a lot about population growth. The one continent in which you have population growth that exceeds replacement level is Africa, right? Africa is also a place with an immense amount of poverty and suffering. So it seems like we would maximize the good if you had to open up all your borders as other states to Africans, so they can leave the plight of their homeland, leave the suffering there, build a new life in Europe or Australia or America, increase the population of those countries, make lots of future people there. That seems like it's going to maximize the good. And therefore, there'd be an obligation on all those countries to open up their borders to the Africans.
Yeah, so you're right about Africa, right? So one of the things we know about Africa is that, you know, by what is it, 2050, they expect there to be, 2.5 billion people there. So, I mean, we're going to have, you know, a vast explosion number of people and probably a vast explosion of poverty if things don't change. So I guess my question is why, I'm not seeing the argument as to why we want to do things which decrease reproduction. I also don't know why we're not concerned about killing the golden goose. I mean, if you were to import people, and I'm not saying this is true of Africans, I'm just saying in general, you know, from country X, Y, or Z, and they don't like the free market, and they don't like political liberty. They're not a big fan, for example, of free speech, which at least one study has suggested that immigrants are less fans of free speech than are Native Americans. Americans were born here. You know, and if you're worried about things like gay rights and protection of freedom of religion, protection of freedom to engage in your sexual relations as you see fit, I'm not sure why you think that we're not going to kill the golden goose, that if we import people who've either voted or tolerated illiberal countries, illiberal governments, both political and economic lack of liberalism, why you think that you're not going to seriously decrease the wealth-generating machine that is some of these developed countries? I mean, why think that if you import, 20 million people into Ireland, you're not going to damage, you know, the wealth-generating machine that is Ireland, or the happiness-generating machine that is the, you know, the Irish people and their economy?
Yeah, so it seems like, as you say, you could act in such a manner where you kill the machine, and that would be bad for net utility. But it could be that there's some right level for maximizing. It could be that it's the current residents of a particular place will be unhappier because they're going to lose some of their culture. Maybe they'll earn less, but the new people coming in, you know, have had this big utility bump, and there's going to be marginal, you know, gains in utility. So let's say the ultra rich in a society become less rich, but they, you know, don't get as much benefit as a, you know, very poor bunch, you know, suddenly leading prosperous lives by comparison. So there's going to be some kind of equilibrium there. I have a different proposal though, which is the debate about immigration seems like an incredibly divisive question in America, and that lots of different Americans hold different views on it. you know, on a spectrum of let everyone in or let no one in or let some people in. And we've discussed it in a manner of the state should decide. And so, you know, you necessarily wind up with some kind of binary outcome, you know, depending on how many representatives you have. And there is another way you could do it, which is instead of allowing the US government to do it, you do it on a smaller level. So cities get to decide, or, you know, particular states get to decide. So as far as I understand, if you want to immigrate to Canada, you don't actually immigrate to Canada, you immigrate to a province. So you have the right then to work in Saskatchewan. You know, you lobby them and they say, okay, well, we need doctors in Saskatchewan. But that doesn't mean that you get to go and work in Alberta. And it does seem that Americans do this on some level, right? So you have sanctuary cities where they say, we're not going to enforce certain obligations that we may have. So we're not going to let ICE agents come in and kick out people who are here illegally. We're just going to let them stick around. It also might be the case that there's some amount of hypocrisy going on there. So, for example, states that border, other countries where you're getting a lot of immigrants coming over. So if you're in the South or you're Florida, you have to bear the brunt of lots of immigrants coming over. Whereas, you know, if you're in Martha's Vineyard, not so much. So Martha's Vineyard can say things like, you know, we're a safe city. But when, you know, Dos Santos sent 50 people on a bus, they completely freaked out and said, you know, get the fuck off my property.
Yeah, I mean, not that they called in the military, right? In 48 hours, they had the military remove them. Yeah, one problem with this theory, letting locality decide, is that it's going to force the country to make an ugly choice. Because you either say, look, this is a country in which we have freedom of movement throughout the country, in which case, Massachusetts or Connecticut could let in, 10 million immigrants. And they just wouldn't stay in those places, right? They might, move to another. And so then you have a choice. You have to say, well, is what matters here is to have freedom of movement and all the liberty that accords us, or do we want local control? It doesn't seem that you can have both if you want local control over immigration. In addition, if you let in a lot of people, let's say you let in a lot of people, but you don't give them work permits, right? You don't give them full citizenship. You say, look, you can come to this country. You know, we let in another 50 million people into the U.S. And we say, well, you can live here, you can work here, but you may not become a citizen, right? We decide that, in fact, the Constitution does not require birthright citizenship, and we don't agree with it. So then you end up with a large population of people, millions, perhaps tens of millions, who are residents but not citizens. And you have to ask yourself, is that the sort of country that you want to live in? I mean, do you really want to live in a country, again, I mentioned the UAE and Qatar, where the vast majority of residents are not citizens? I mean, you have a real sort of class, it's not just class differences, it's kind of privileges difference. And you might think this is atrocious, and you might also think that this is no way to protect our liberal rights. If you have a lot of residents who are not citizens, you might think they're not going to be particularly ardent. They're not going to be particularly motivated to insist on their right of free speech, right? The right of sexuality, the right of movement, the right of religion. And so you lose freedom because you have people in the country who don't have full citizenship and don't have the means, don't have the motivation, or don't have the law behind them to insist on their liberal rights. So I think local control is going to conflict with freedom of movement within a country. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is, if you're admitting large numbers of people and you're not giving them citizenship, you have the problem of, a very distasteful system, and you have the threat of losing the liberal rights that we value so much.
Suppose I own a house, or let's say a business. So let's say I own a business, and in order for that business to flourish, I need to trade with people around me. But the people who live down the street, they've erected a wall around my home. It's not immediately on the border of my home, but it's close, or my business. The people who I want to trade with can't enter. They can't come in. And maybe I just want visitors. Never mind trade. I just want to see my friends. And I can't do so because the people around me have erected this wall. It seems like maybe you could argue they haven't violated my rights, but they've certainly violated or undermined my liberty. Like, they've certainly reduced my quality of life. They've reduced my ability to flourish. They've reduced the ability of my business to find trading partners or my home to find visitors. That seems to be exactly what's happening if you're a resident in a country and there's strong borders around that country. People can't enter in order to trade and visit.
Yes, I think that's true, but I don't think it's a wrong maker present. Again, leave aside consequential considerations. I mean, imagine a wealthy man like you have all sorts of really nice and fun friends. And every time you make one of these friends, you're this wealthy, ultra wealthy man says, look, I'm going to pay you $1 million to attend Cornell, which is far away from South Africa. And so as a result, he buys out your friendship network. It's a little hard. He certainly has reduced your quality of life. But it's a little hard to see how he's restricted your freedom. I mean, he hasn't coerced you anyway. He hasn't touched your body or your stuff. It's not clear that he's infringed a right of yours. I mean, I don't think you have a right that a wealthy man not buy out your friends. Well, I'm a little bit at a loss just to see how this case of the wealthy man buying out your friends is different from the person paying for the wall. I mean, again, it may be sort of a horrible thing to do. He may be a bad person, but it's hard to see what the wrong maker is. Now, when it comes to collective property, there's something very different going on here, which is that in a lot of these countries, collective property has quite a lot of value. I mean, things like, the American roads, the American parks, the various assets that a country has are quite valuable. It's a little hard to see why they should be restrictive as to who uses those property. So let's talk about, the Ivy League in the U.S. are privately owned universities with enormous amounts of wealth and gorgeous facilities, right? Oftentimes in beautiful pieces of land. And all the time it says, look, you may not sit in the classes available, even if it's under-enrolled. You may not use the pool. You may not, go hiking. You may not climb on the campus walls. So it's a little hard to see how the fact the Ivy League tells you may not enjoy their facilities unless they've admitted you or unless you're an owner. Sorry, that's a little bit of an issue as to who exactly owns an Ivy League school, but leaving that aside, how's that any different than the Wall case? I don't think it is. And if it's okay for the Ivy League to say, well, we can exclude you from our facilities, we can exclude you from our grounds and from our classes. I mean, this strikes me as similar to the wall. It's just the wall seems like it's done intentionally, and the Ivy League exclusion is done just foreseeably.